Word of mouth.
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 I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is a special fundraising archive edition of Word of Mouth from NHPR. While the cost and management of healthcare remains a hotly contested issue in America, not so long ago, people with aches and pains and other maladies had other issues to grapple with. Treatment. Back then, patients were treated with mercury and other poisons to induce sweating and vomiting, maybe a bloodletting to release the ill humors. Perhaps a phrenologist would examine your skull for irregularities. A mesmerist might quicken the magnetic flow of your brain. Or you'd be treated with an herbal tincture or some other snake oil-like brew. These pseudoscientific quackeries proliferated in the 19th century and inspired throngs of followers. Many were developed by people, including women, shunned by formal medicine. Erica Janik is author of Marketplace of the Marvelous, The Strange Origins of Modern Medicine. We spoke with her when the book came out last year. Erica Janik, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me.
You help describe the state of medicine in the 19th century, quite primitive, and little seemed to have changed since the 1700s. Give us a little bit of a background there, and this idea of heroic therapy that keeps coming up. What does that mean?
Yeah, so heroic sounds like it's, you know, going to cure everything like a hero will do. But heroic was the type of medicine that was very commonly practiced by mainstream doctors in the 19th century. And a lot of the treatments that they were using as part of these heroic treatments were things that had actually been used for centuries. They actually traced back to ancient Rome and Greece. And so the main forms of healing involved bleeding, blistering, causing you to vomit by giving you certain drugs and chemicals. The reason it was called heroic just referred to the large dose. It caused such an extreme or drastic reaction in the patient. And that's really what people kind of wanted out of medicine. It did change your symptoms. So if you had a fever and they bled you, your symptoms would change. They wouldn't necessarily cure your fever, but something would have happened. And that made people feel like their treatment was actually working, that they were getting better. And all of this was based on the idea of the four humors, which go all the way back to Galen in Rome. And it was really just about a body in balance. And they thought that if you had some kind of sickness, it just meant that something in your body was out of alignment. And so they needed to do some kind of intervention in order to get you back on track.
And heroic medicine was practiced by the doctors, I'm saying that in air quotes, of the age, because many of them were not trained as doctors. And this is opposed to irregular medicine, practices that were developed by people sort of on the margins. What are some of those?
You know, it's really a product of the time. There's all kinds of changes happening to American society with industrialization and urbanization, and there's lots of reform movements forming, you know, things like temperance and abolition. And so health is just a natural extension of all of these groups that are kind of coming together. And so some of the ideas that people had were hydropathy. They suggested the idea that cold water could cure basically everything. And the way that they applied treatment was through a variety of different soaking and bathing and drinking regimes. And it was actually pretty a tough thing. Like, treatment could last all day long, and people took it 7 days a week for weeks on end, just trying to flush all of this disease out of the body. There were other people like Samuel Thompson who thought that a lot of the chemicals that people were getting from their regular doctors, things like mercury, were, you know, very dangerous. And he suggested instead that people should be treating themselves with things from nature, plants and fungus and bark, because, you know, he said that everything we need to cure ourselves exists out in the world. And so he developed a whole system that was based on these natural remedies. And, you know, that's something that people are very fond of today. You know, you find all kinds of companies and things promoting natural products, natural ingredients. So he was really hitting on something, you know, 2 centuries ago.
Mm-hmm. And of course, people were easily seduced by the urge of a cure. As you point out, people were often ill in 19th century America.
That's right. I mean, if you were alive then, your life was basically filled with illness. You know, conditions were pretty unsanitary. We didn't really know a lot about health. You know, we didn't know about germs. We didn't understand how diseases were actually spread through human contact or through insects. And in America, you know, this is a very large country, and people were living pretty spread out. And so there weren't a lot of doctors to begin with. And then people often lived very far away from where they could actually get medical help. And so, you know, a lot of people were really suffering from diseases. And so they were desperate, desperate to get really any treatment, anything that would make them feel better.
And it also appeals to that American singularity, you know, that we can do this ourselves. One could cure themselves with hydrotherapy, for example.
That's right. You know, a lot of these doctors were really promoting the idea that, kind of seizing on that idea of American individualism. They really wanted to give people the tools to heal themselves, and Americans loved that.
This was a gap into which women walked in big numbers. Why did women flourish in the irregular medicine trade? Like women like Lydia Pinkham, who came up with these medicinal brews that, beginning with her neighbors, you know, flocking to her door in the 1870s as a cottage industry, eventually patented it and put it on the market.
Yeah, so women really find a place for themselves in irregular medicine because women's health was something that was not really addressed. A lot of women didn't actually go see doctors themselves because kind of social propriety of the time, it just wasn't seemly for a respectable woman to go see a male doctor and to be examined. And even if she did go see a male doctor, he often wouldn't actually examine her because he would be worried about offending her and he didn't want to touch her or look at her. And so not really much was known about women's health. And so a lot of women suffered in silence. And so irregular doctors and proprietors, people like Lydia Pinkham, really seized on an opportunity to help women out. Women needed doctors, and they needed people who were going to help them with their particular problems. And so Lydia Pinkham, for example, put together a remedy that was specifically geared towards women. She really advertised it as something to help women with their problems. Yeah, I mean, that was one of the things that I was most excited about as I was researching this, because, you know, I kind of went into this project thinking the story that I thought I knew, which was that, you know, doctors were beating back all of these quacks who were just selling people alcohol and drugs disguised as medicine. But the more I read about these irregular healers, I was realizing that a lot of the things that they were promoting, even if they took them to the wrong ends, were actually kind of right on. So one of the things that starts happening is you find irregular ideas as they're being challenged by regular doctors. That's also causing mainstream medicine to kind of look at itself and wonder, well, maybe we should check this out. You know, often it was an effort to disprove one of these ideas. If we think about phrenology, for example, you know, that really was a science that supposedly could read your character on the shape of your skull. They thought that the skull was actually an accurate cast of your brain beneath it, and so they could just feel for the bumps on your head and then tell you what kind of personality you had. You know, it's kind of a strange idea when you think about it now, but the idea, people had thought for centuries that your brain was really just kind of one organ, and there was a lot of disagreement, too, about where different bodily functions and emotions, where they were actually housed in the body. People weren't necessarily sure that the brain was really this command center of the body. They thought maybe some of this stuff came from the heart or maybe the liver. And so Gall, who founded phrenology, you know, his suggestion that the brain perhaps had different parts that governed different functions was really innovative and really controversial at the time. And actually, some of the advances that were then later made in brain science were an attempt to disprove him. And in their efforts to disprove that, they actually discovered that he had gotten some things right, even though the idea of actually feeling your head to see whether you know, are good at music or writing poetry is a little bit ridiculous.
Gall was one. Samuel Thompson, who you mentioned before, an itinerant healer and maker of botanic medicines. He was born here in New Hampshire, by the way, in 1769, as was Mary Baker Eddy, founder of the Christian Science Movement and Church. And I'd love you to talk a little bit about that idea that these irregular healers were able to command throngs of people, attract a lot of people to their ways of thinking. What was going on socially at that time to embrace these irregular treatments in such an emphatic way?
So in the 19th century, you know, there was just so many things that were really changing about American life. There were all kinds of technological advances. There was religious revivalism going on. You know, it was really just kind of a swirling time that was changing very fast. And there were all kinds of improvements being made in all different aspects of people's lives. But one of the areas that really wasn't seeing any improvement was medicine. And so that really opened it up to having all of these alternatives. And a lot of the people that became the big promoters of it, like Samuel Thompson and Mary Baker Eddy, were very good at telling a good story of explaining how their system actually worked, explaining how disease worked in the body and how their cure would actually fix it. And they were very tireless in their promotion. I mean, that's one of the things that irregular healers were very good at in the 19th century, is kind of seizing on some of the new technologies that were available, things like the penny press. It was much cheaper to print advertisements and print books than it had ever been before. And a lot of these irregular healers really seized on that and found ways to market their products. And so people, you know, we're reading about these things all of the time. And they were traveling around giving demonstrations of it. And so it was kind of only natural that some famous people in the 19th century would, you know, happen to be at a performance or see someone getting their head read and be curious about it. You know, Mark Twain must have tried every single remedy in the 19th century. And he wrote often very funny things about them. And, you know, he thought a lot of them were ridiculous. But at the same time, he kept going back and getting his head read by a phrenologist. You know, he went at least 3 times that we know of, and he could have gone even more. And so I think people were just really curious. And as I said, the 19th century is a time of great sickness, and people really want to be well. And so they're willing to try things. And these irregular healers offered remedies that were generally cheaper than going to see a mainstream doctor. And often they could do it themselves. And as we know, you know, Americans like to do things themselves, and they like a good deal. Mm. You know, Americans in the 19th century are not different than us. And so those things were just as attractive to them as they would be to us today.
Well, today, that tension exists in many circles with the regular healers and the irregular healers, what we would call today, you know, Western medicine and non-traditional medicines. But that is becoming more and more integrated at places like the Mayo Clinic, you know, where they do meditation, for example, in part of cancer treatment. What are some of the other examples of how these quote-unquote irregular medical therapies have integrated and become much more accepted by those who are trained as doctors?
Well, I think the rise of, you know, what is now called integrative or complementary health, which is really the bringing together of these regular and irregular therapies, would be rather shocking to people in the 19th century who kind of fought this bloodbath to kind of dominate health. But I think, you know, over time, as people started trying a lot of these methods, because these irregular therapies in the 19th century were very prevalent, lots of people tried them. And, you know, as we've already said, they got actually a few things right. You know, drinking water is a good idea. Exercising is a good idea. And as regular medicine kind of evolved over time, you know, they kind of absorbed some of these ideas from these irregular healers.
Erica Janik, radio producer and author, most recently of Marketplace of the Marvelous, The Strange Origins of Modern Medicine. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
For more on this and her other history books, as well as Wisconsin Life, which she produces and edits for Wisconsin Public Radio, go to our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. It is easy to write off product placement as a cheesy, distasteful form of advertising. While that's often the case, a handful of product tie-ins have gone even further to influence consumers and even make headlines, like this classic TV moment, which has been imitated and parodied ever since. And that is a clip from the 2004 episode of The Oprah Winfrey Show, when the media mogul gave every single person in the audience a free car. The tie-in was featured in Ad Age's recent list of the top 10 product placements of the past 10 years. Ad Age staff writer Michael Sebastian co-wrote the article and joins us with more. Michael, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So before you did any research for this list, could you remember which kind of car Oprah gave away that day?
No, absolutely not.
I thought it was a Cadillac. It was a Pontiac.
Yeah, Pontiac, it was the G6, which I believe has been discontinued.
So why do you think that moment, if not the car, has stayed with us, while so many other product tie-ins have been forgotten almost instantly?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, first of all, it comes from Oprah Winfrey, who, you know, herself is such a force in the media and in culture. So that's an important part of it. But also, I mean, it had such legs. It moved so much. I mean, it was parodied on Saturday Night Live. I feel like, you know, there's probably a lot of people who may not have seen the original version that you just played, but they certainly saw the parody of it, or they saw some version of it that really resonated with them.
Another car-related product placement that made your list, the blockbuster Transformers films. Remind us.
Yeah, so Transformers, the franchise, had teamed up with GM, and you know, as one executive in the show business community told me that basically the first Transformers movie is just a 2-hour long commercial for the Chevy Camaro, which is a cynical but interesting way of looking at it.
Something I did not realize until I read your article, that not all product placements involve financial transactions. What's behind them?
Sure, yeah, absolutely. Often a product placement will involve a trade. We see a lot of that, as a matter of fact. So, for instance, a movie studio might need an airplane or an airport hangar or an airport area to film in. And instead of going through the whole rigmarole of figuring out how to do that, they might reach out to an airline, say an American Airlines or a Southwest Airlines, and say, hey, can we use your airplane, use your hangar, use your space in an airport? And in exchange for that, your branding can be in the movie.
I'd like to play a clip from the trailer for the 2009 film Up in the Air, starring George Clooney. He was the ultimate frequent flyer.
Last year, I spent 322 days on the road. I flew 350,000 miles. The moon is 250. All the things you probably hate about traveling are warm reminders that I am home.
Welcome back, Mr. Bingham.
Now, listeners can't see this, but may remember that trailer was plastered with American Airlines branding. We tend to think of product placement as pretty cheesy, but Up in the Air was an Oscar-winning, critically acclaimed film. How did it transcend the shill label?
Great question, and I think that it was so organic, which is a word that marketers love to use when it comes to this kind of thing. I mean, if it hadn't been an actual airline, one that exists, I mean, if they had gone ahead and made a fake airline, I think that it would have been distracting. You know, people see a movie like this that was really based in realism. I mean, Up in the Air came out at a time when people were being laid off, and it was about a layoff expert. And it would have been distracting if it hadn't been an airline that they had flown with.
On the other side of the divide, there's the 2010 made-for-TV movie called Secrets of the Mountain. Why did this one make your list?
Yeah, this is an interesting one because this was a partnership with Walmart and Procter & Gamble, and it was almost a throwback to some of the kind of soap operas that we would have seen, I mean, even going back to the 50s, 60s, something like that. And this aired on NBC, and this was designed to draw consumers to buy P&G products at Walmart. And, I mean, for their time slot, it drew a pretty good audience. And, you know, this is like considered the holy grail of branded entertainment.
So how did it come off? Was it a knock you over the head with product placement kind of movie?
You know, not as bad as one would suspect, actually. I mean, I think that, you know, there was certainly P&G products within there, but it wasn't as if it was, you know, like that scene from Wayne's World where Wayne holds up the pizza box with a grin.
Well, that is a really funny one. It's not always subtle. The Wayne's World movie was pretty hilarious in making fun of product placement while doing it overtly. And in 2012, the Colbert Report did the same thing. Here's a clip from a nearly 7-minute segment about Wheat Thins.
I would love to pour this whole box in my mouth right now. But the memo clearly states that we can't show overconsumption. That is a brand don't. You see, the serving size for Wheat Thins is 16 crackers. So as delicious as they are, I shouldn't eat more than 16. And also, if they are shown out of the box, like in a bowl, there should only be a max of 16. So remember, everyone, while Wheat Thins is, quote, a snack for anyone who is actively seeking experiences, those experiences do not include the experience of eating 17 crackers. And you know what? That is the way it should be. Because when you think about it, and they have, 16 is the perfect number of Wheat Thins to keep you on the path to and proud of doing what you love to do, no matter what that is. No matter what.
Stephen Colbert there. So, Michael Sebastian, was that a win for Wheat Thins, even though its brand strategy is clearly being made fun of?
It was definitely a win. I mean, you don't go on the Colbert Report or team up with Stephen Colbert unless you have a sense of humor, or at least think you have a sense of humor. And I think that what we saw here was, you know, something that would appeal to not only his audience, but also the next level, so to speak, of product placement, which is this whole idea of an overt wink and nod to the camera and even making fun of it. But guess what? The message got across.
Here is an item on your list that had a real functional value. Now, that was the partnership between AT&T and American Idol. Why does that rate?
You know, that rates as maybe one of the most important product placements because it, as at least one executive in the ad industry told me, taught America how to text message. I mean, obviously, how many people text message now? Prior to that partnership, you know, it wasn't something that was ubiquitous in the way that it is today. So, I mean, that product placement and partnership caused a real kind of cultural shift. I mean, you could argue that it was going to happen anyway, but this certainly sped it along.
You write, Michael, that product placement actually saved a couple of television shows from being canceled. How did that happen?
In the case that we're talking about, it's both Chuck and Community, and teamed up with Subway, which ended up underwriting the costs of the production in exchange for some serious product placement within the two shows.
Here's a clip from the third season of Community. This is after Subway stepped in and saved the show from being canceled.
Any business operating for profit on Greendale's campus must be at least 51% owned by a registered Greendale student.
That's too bad, Dean. I don't recall seeing Subway in my premenopausal post-feminist experiential marketing class.
Actually, I'm on the wait list for the pre-men post-fem X mark.
Who are you?
Gang, meet Greendale's newest student, Subway.
Your name is Subway.
Yep.
Okay. Pretty overt. Seems like the original idea around product placement was to integrate advertising into programming so that viewers wouldn't really notice that they were being pitched. But the trend I'm seeing is making product placement pretty obvious and pretty funny rather than, you know, the subconscious approach. Is that what you're seeing too?
To some extent. I think that you nailed the one part about kind of that sense of humor. And I think for a show like Community, the audience would have rejected it if they hadn't taken that approach. But on the other hand, another big trend that we're seeing is sort of brands working with showrunners, producers, Hollywood execs at the ground level, meaning when they're developing a series or when they're sitting down to write an episode, they're talking about not only how they can work the product into the show, but how they can work kind of the spirit of the product or the spirit of the brand into a show at the very start. Now, you won't get a lot of studios talking at length about this because I think there's a certain dark art quality to it. But at the same time, this is really kind of the emerging trend in this space.
Well, Michael Sebastian, watching the trends as a staff writer at Ad Age, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Michael co-wrote the top 10 product placements of the last 10 years list. You can see it for yourself at wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In a court of law, juries are often asked to determine whether a defendant is guilty of criminal intent or some contributing factor compelled him or her to commit the crime. Understandably, lawyers have made all sorts of arguments as to why a defendant should not be responsible. think the Twinkie defense, a derisive term used during coverage of the trial of the man accused of killing San Francisco City Supervisor Harvey Milk, along with the mayor. This episode of the podcast Criminal takes a look back at the first use of the PMS defense.
She kept saying three things. I didn't mean to hurt my child. I don't remember what happened. I just got my period.
About 30 years ago, something started happening in courtrooms that caught the world by surprise. Lawyers began to attribute criminal behavior to PMS, or premenstrual syndrome. The first time was in England. A woman named Sandy Smith was found guilty of murdering her coworker, but her lawyer argued she was suffering from PMS, and the judge gave her probation for murder. Then shortly after, the PMS defense was tried out in the U.S. in a case that pit scientists against feminists against lawyers.
Serious topic here, folks. She beat her kids and she blames her PMS. Should PMS be used as a legal defense? We'll find out. Take a break. Stay with us.
Shirley was on the bed, passed out or in a state of semi-unconsciousness. The child came in after specifically being told not to come in the room because Shirley was sick and couldn't take care of her kids, that they had to stay in the other room. She came in and she jumped on her. And she reacted in a reflexive way. She said that the daughter said to her, "Mommy, you hit me."
Shirley Santos was 24 years old in 1981, a single mother with six kids in Brooklyn. This is her lawyer, Stephanie Benson.
She herself called the police. And not only did she call the police, she didn't have a phone. She had to go to a neighbor to whom she said, "Look, I just got my period, and I think I might have hurt my child."
But if we're saying that PMS at this point in the early 80s wasn't in the lexicon, why did she know to attribute something to that?
She didn't say PMS. She never said PMS. This is what she knew happened to her at this time of the month. And maybe it doesn't take a PhD for a woman to know why she feels crappy.
A few hours later, Santos was arrested. Court documents show that her four-year-old child had bruises and welts. Her kids were taken away. In 1981, lawyer Stephanie Benson was also 24 years old, working for Legal Aid. She was assigned to Shirley Santos.
Had you done any research or reading or anything on PMS as a legal defense, maybe as it related to the British cases beforehand, or was this something that just came to you out of the blue?
It came to me out of the blue.
This is Benson on McNeil Lair that year. Based on what she found, Benson felt she could correlate Santos's behavior with what doctors were learning about PMS. There were cases of women whose symptoms were so severe they felt capable of hurting themselves or others. She filed a motion to dismiss the case, outlining for the court all of the ways in which her client was, quote, a victim of PMS. Today we're used to women saying, "I have PMS." We haven't exactly moved beyond stereotypes about women being crazy at that time of the month. These jokes are everywhere, even on pretty forward-thinking shows like Modern Family.
God, they're going to ruin everything.
No. We just need to be extra sensitive.
Phil, honey, when do we need to leave?
Whatever's good for you, sweetie. Maybe 20 minutes?
20 minutes!
Whenever you're ready.
But back in the 80s and 90s, it really was new and hard to make sense of. Not only was it totally out of left field to assert that a woman's period could be debilitating, but it had very problematic implications.
What would be the consequences if PMS were admitted as a legitimate defense in court, in your view?
It's much more significantly a sword to be used against women than a shield for them.
This is Barbara Newman, one of the prosecuting attorneys in the Santos case.
No woman could ever be trusted with any position of responsibility, including having children, having the care and custody of children. This could justify assaults upon women. The man could say, "This woman was out of control. I had to kill her," and there's the woman dead on the floor, not in a position to refute it.
The Santos case may have been the first in the U.S., but the other cases that got the public's attention made the diagnosis seem even more serious, like Sandy Smith in England, who we mentioned earlier. She was charged with murder after she stabbed her coworker repeatedly, or Christine English, who ran down her lover with her car and pinned him after the affair went south. After the two violent cases in England, and now Santos, it looked like PMS as a defense was gathering steam.
I became interested because my branch chief at the time said, I have met an endocrinologist, and he claims that there are four women in his practice who attempted suicide during the luteal phase of their menstrual cycle.
This is Dr. David Rubineau, chair of the Department of Psychiatry at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and founder of the Women's Mood Disorder Clinic there. Today he specializes in the most severe form of PMS. It has its own name, premenstrual dysphoric disorder, often just PMDD.
PMS or PMDD is triggered by changes in reproductive hormones, estrogen or progesterone. But that triggering occurs only in a subgroup of women, a group of women who are susceptible to hormone-induced mood changes. And we don't understand exactly what causes that susceptibility, but it is a biologically triggered syndrome. And we can demonstrate that. I can take someone who has PMS, PMDD, and I can eliminate her syndrome by stopping her ovarian steroid secretion. And PMDD will go away.
So this is kind of the evidence that this isn't just all in her head.
Exactly.
Well, it's not really a diagnosis. It's a social belief.
This is Dr. Neda Stotland. She's a psychiatrist in Chicago specializing in women's mental health and was president of the American Psychiatric Association from 2008 to 2009.
If we really believe that, are we going to screen every woman before she gets a responsible job? What about all the flight controllers and the pilots and the surgeons? Do you think 7% of female surgeons or 5% are disabled for several days a month? I don't believe it. And I do have an objection to having this diagnosis listed as a psychiatric diagnosis without any comparable investigation of the impact of male hormones on men.
Why?
Because women's hormones are used as an excuse to think that women are unstable. You know, we talked about at one point, you know, do you want a woman to have the red telephone in the president's office? That's a very dangerous and negative understanding of women and a denigration of their legitimate problems.
Back in the 80s in Brooklyn, the Santos case got more and more complicated. Shirley Santos totally undermined her own case when she told a TV reporter, "It's not like I'm going to get my period so bad I start wailing on my child." It was a mess. It's still unclear whether she was pressured by the reporter or if she actually didn't believe her own defense. The lawyers made a deal. Santos pled guilty to a reduced charge, down from felony assault to a simple harassment violation, not even a misdemeanor, and she went home without her kids.
Why don't you think this has been part of the legal discourse since then?
You have to have a very special mixture. So you have a woman, and women don't commit that many crimes. A violent crime, women don't commit that many violent crimes.
I personally do not believe that PMS causes murder.
Again, Dr. David Rubineau, head of UNC's Women's Mood Disorder Clinic.
I do think that someone who has antecedent behavioral problems may experience further compromise of their ability to regulate their behavior when they become increasingly symptomatic during the premenstrual state. But women with really severe PMDD do not kill people.
We talked to other scientists, just asked them, could it actually be this bad? They said yes. In some rare instances, PMDD could manifest itself so severely that a woman would be taken out of her ordinary mental state. And last year, the American Psychiatric Association put PMDD in their big book of mental disorders, the DSM-5. They classified it as a depressive disorder, saying the move was based on strong scientific evidence. So the science has evolved. What remains to be seen is whether or not public opinion has too.
Okay, before we go, I just want to get a, give us a round of applause if you think that PMS should be a valid legal defense. Do you believe it? Well, I guess that's that. Who thinks it should not be a valid legal defense?
And that story was part of the PRX STEM Story Project, made possible by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation.